Marcia Coral and her new thriller, Matchmaking for Psychopaths. Now it's time for Weekend Edition.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. President Trump is threatening to send National Guard troops to Chicago. He says to crack down on crime and illegal immigration. We'll tell you more. And the annual United Nations General Assembly will kick off in New York this week, but the U.S. has blocked the president of the Palestinian Authority from attending. Find out more. Plus, we talked to a chef who has an ear for good food.
Great chefs have all their senses awake when they're cooking.
The sound is more higher pitched now, less wet.
It's Sunday, September 7th. News is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. The Department of Natural Resources is recognizing three Northland conservation officers for their life-saving efforts this year. Park Rapids CO Nick Baum received the life-saving award for his part of a rescue operation on the Fishhook River. An angler had fallen through the ice this March, and while attempting to rescue him, a responding officer also went through. Baum helped pull the officer and angler out. Reamer CO Corey Sura was also recognized for his role in an ice rescue on the same day in March. An ATV fell through the ice on Big Rice Lake in Cass County while Sura was speaking to an angler on shore about 400 yards away. With the assistance of the angler, he was able to rescue the two riders from the submerged ATV. International Fall CO Kurt Simonson received the award for his role in a search for an elderly diabetic man this July. Simonson checked trails and noticed tracks leading to the missing man's Jeep. The man was found behind the vehicle lying on his side, covered in flies and mud. He was taken to a hospital and released the next day. The Minnesota Public Utilities Commission will host three public hearings on Minnesota Power's proposed Boswell Solar Project on Wednesday and Thursday. The utility has applied for a site and route permit for its 85-megawatt project and the associated 2.5-mile transmission line. The solar project will span parts of Cohasset, the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe Reservation, and Deer Lake Township. Attendees will be able to ask questions of state staff and Minnesota Power, comment on the merits of the project, and suggest possible conditions for the permits. The first meeting will be at the Bina Community Center at noon Wednesday. The second will be later that day at 6 at the Cohasset Community Center. An online public meeting will begin at 6 p.m. Thursday. Find the link to that meeting and more on how to comment at kaxe.org. Comments are open through September 25th. Crow Wing County is reminding the public that September is National Preparedness Month. Crow Wing County Public Health is helping guide residents on what to include in a basic emergency kit. Gradually building a kit is more affordable, and it helps prepare for supply shortages in case of a disaster. Ace Hardware stores in Brainerd, Nisswa, and Crosby will have green tags on items recommended for an emergency kit, and checklists are available near the front of each store. The public health team will also have a booth at area libraries this month to share more about emergency kits. They'll be at the Hallett Library Thursday, September 11th from 9 to 11 a.m. You can also catch them at the Brainerd Library on September 16th or the Cross Lake Area Library on September 30th, also from 9 to 11. Imagine seeing your child struggle with school issues, but educators can't see it. This can occur for households seeking special education services as Minnesota districts and parents work through unique cases. Individualized education programs are a key tool K-12 schools use when meeting the learning needs of students with disabilities, such as autism or speech and hearing impairments. Federal law mandates IEPs, but a medical diagnosis doesn't lead to automatic approval, with negative impacts on learning or social skills also required. Administrator Todd Tetzlaff with North Branch Area Public Schools says what's playing out at home might be different than what's happening in the classroom.
The child is very distracted, they're off task, But then at school, you know, they're gathering data and they're looking at, boy, the kids' assignment completion rate is 95%.
Some parents contend at-home concerns warrant formal services out of fear things will quickly spiral in the classroom. Tetzlaff says they don't want to be premature in putting a child under the special education umbrella. He reminds families to request new evaluations if things change, with fewer steps needed if it happens within 12 months. Educators and parents say cases are becoming more complex with multiple conditions, and in rare situations, families making full use of the alternative dispute resolution process. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for this story. That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
In addition from NPR News, I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning and thank you for being with us today. President Trump is doubling down on deploying the National Guard to Chicago. Here he is speaking to the press at the Oval Office on Tuesday.
There's no place in the world, including you can go to Afghanistan, you can go to places that you would think of. They don't even come close to this. Chicago is a hellhole right now.
And yesterday, referring to his rebranding of the Defense Department, the president posted on True Social, Chicago about to find out why it's called the Department of War. He also posted what looked like an image of Chicago's skyline on fire. We're joined now by NPR senior national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Good morning, Mara.
Good morning.
So, you know, President Trump was campaigning on being nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. So what's going on here with this focus on a War Department?
Trump considers himself a master brander. You know, he paves over the Rose Garden and calls it the Rose Garden Club. He invents biting, denigrating nicknames for his opponents that sometimes hit the mark. Remember Little Marco? And he decided that the Department of Defense needed a rebranding. So he gave it a secondary title. Officially renaming it would take an act of Congress. So he's come up with this name, the Department of War. It could backfire. As you said, he ran as the guy who was going to keep us out of wars. And it raises the question, does he want to get into a war, or is this just an effort to make the U.S. sound tougher? And the rebranding does come at a time when he's been accused by his critics of being too deferential, when he's confronted with tough adversaries like Russia and China. But now he's talking about instigating a conflict with Democratic-controlled cities like Chicago and possibly federalizing the National Guard there.
Okay, so in Illinois, Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker, he pushed back on the president's claims, saying in a post on Blue Sky that Trump is, quote, a wannabe dictator, and adding that the president is going to war with Chicago. But the president said he's moving ahead with this plan, right?
Sounds like it. He has talked about sending troops to Democratic-run cities for quite some time. Unlike the District of Columbia, where he did send National Guard troops, the district is a federal district, not a state. It's unclear whether courts are going to allow him to do this in places where governors control their state National Guard troops. He's already had one court ruling against him about sending troops to Los Angeles over the objections of the governor there. And part of this, as Trump himself has explained, is political. He says the midterm elections will be about crime. He wants them to be about crime. He says the crime issue is good for Republicans, and he doesn't want them to be about the Jeffrey Epstein files or vaccines or the economy.
Well, I mean, but speaking of the economy, the job numbers that came out, they don't look too good. Like, is there a positive spin for President Trump here?
There could be. Polls show that majorities of Americans are very unhappy about the economy. They disapprove of his performance on trade, on the economy. His One Big Beautiful Bill Act is very unpopular. But there could be a positive spin if Trump can get people to focus on the tax cuts in that bill, because that's the only part of the bill that people do like. Now, we might get an idea of what one part of the public thinks about Trump today, because he's attending the men's final at the U.S. Open. There have been reports that broadcasters of the match have been told not to cover any potential protests, but everyone has a camera.
Okay, but in keeping with the rebranding theme, you talked about the problems with the Big Beautiful Bill. Are they trying to rebrand that now?
Yes, they certainly are. President Trump said a few weeks ago that the original branding, One Big Beautiful Bill, was, quote, good for getting it approved, but not good for explaining to people what it's about. So now Republicans are trying to call it the Working Families Tax Cut Act.
Okay, so things are heating up also with this redistricting fight. Texas is redrawing its map, and California's voters will decide if they'll do the same. What are you watching for there?
Well, Republicans have a clear advantage when it comes to redistricting because they control more trifectas, meaning they control more governor's mansions and state legislatures in the same state. So it's easier for them to pass new maps. It's also easier for them to gerrymander, draw districts that give them a partisan advantage, because Democratic voters are inefficiently clustered in cities and along the coasts. But Democrats are trying to do the same thing. And California voters are going to vote on redistricting in November. And this brings us back to the top of our conversation, the National Guard being sent to Democratic cities. Some Democrats worry it has more to do with elections than anything else. Here is Governor J.B. Pritzker of Illinois talking to MSNBC's Jen Psaki on Friday.
Honestly, sending National Guard in has nothing to do with immigration either. What it has to do with is he's trying to set the stage for interference in the elections in 2026 and in 2028.
And that's what Democrats worry about.
That's NPR's Mara Liasson. Thank you, Mara.
Thank you.
Every year in New York City, about 150 world leaders attend the United Nations General Assembly, known as UNGA or UNGA. One leader will be notably absent at the meeting this month, the president of the Palestinian Authority, the party in charge of roughly 40% of the West Bank. The U.S. has blocked him and 80 other Palestinian officials by revoking their visas, a decision the U.N. has opposed. At least five Western countries have said they will recognize a Palestinian state at the meeting, something the Trump administration opposes. To understand what's at stake, we've reached Hadi Amer. He's the former U.S. Special Representative for Palestinian Affairs and is currently with the Brookings Institution. Welcome to the program.
Honored to be here. Your show's a national treasure.
Oh, thank you so much. What is the implication of not having the Palestinian officials present at the meeting, where obviously the war in Gaza and discussions of a Palestinian state will probably be front and center?
The direct implications of the administration blocking the visas is limited to preventing those individuals from coming, the 90-year-old Palestinian leader and his entourage. But Palestinian recognition will still go ahead as planned. It prevents some of the pomp and circumstance that, you know, would have occurred. It's probably a violation of the 1940s treaty establishing the UN headquarters in New York. It's a bad look for the United States. Does it make us look weak? Does it make us look strong? Does it make us look wise? I think it's the former, not the latter. Yes.
Well, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has been in power for 20 years without calling elections, and the Palestinian Authority's popularity is at its lowest in years. What is the state of Palestinian leadership today?
Look, this is unquestionably the darkest chapter in modern Palestinian history, with the human catastrophe in Gaza, the ongoing challenges in the West Bank, you know, over 60,000 killed in Gaza, you know, 3% of the population, a per capita equivalent of 10 million Americans, an unconscionable bloodbath live streamed on TV. So there's no question that any Palestinian leader that has endured the last few years would be deeply unpopular. And as you noted, Abbas is, you know, 20 years into his four-year term. They have not held elections, which is not entirely their own fault because it requires Israel to allow them to vote, to have voting in Jerusalem, as was the case in the elections that I personally observed, you know, 20 years, you know, years ago. You know, they are deeply unpopular. So yes, the PA has many flaws. Many of them are baked into the system. And it's they're in a bind, in a sense, where they, on the one hand, they're supposed to be advancing the freedom, security, and prosperity of their people, but at the other hand, you know, promoting Israel's interests and trying to keep Israel safe. So it's a real, they're in a real bind. He is deeply unpopular, and I'm not sure that, you know, any leader, even if there were a Palestinian Bush, Obama, Clinton, or even Trump, would be popular at this juncture in Palestinian society.
What do you make of the, you know, the decision to block Palestinian leaders from attending the General Assembly, especially considering that the Palestinian Authority is not designated a terrorist organization, unlike Hamas, and the U.S. has discussed having the PA participate in governance of Gaza after the war is over. Is this a bad sign for that?
Look, I think that the administration is trying to apply pressure to the PA, to the Palestinian leadership, to get it to take steps that it wants. It's not, and so that's clear. And I think that's also clear to the Palestinians. It's just not clear to me what they can do to appease this, to appease the Trump administration. So. That's kind of the situation that we're in. But you're right, it's not a good sign. And I think for those who, you know, if you believe in the idea of the Jewish people and the Palestinian people, you know, kind of equally deserving the same levels of freedom, security, and prosperity, and you believe in the idea of a two-state solution where the West Bank and Gaza would be integrated as a Palestinian state eventually, it's really not a good sign for that.
Former U.S. Special Representative for Palestinian Affairs, Hadi Amer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to NPR News.
You're tuned in to Weekend Edition here on member-supported KAXE-KBXE. And now a message paid for by the Minnesota Department of Health. Sometimes you just need to talk about it, but it can be hard to find someone who really listens. That's why there is 988, with support that meets you where you are. Confidential and staffed by trained folks who want to help you when you need someone to talk to. Call or text 988 or chat online at 988lifeline.org. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kibbe, exploring the distinctly American art form. Hear more Jazz Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer-hosted Jazz on America Avenue. Programming is supported by the Bush Foundation, accepting application for the 2026 Bush Fellowship September 2nd through noon on October 7th. The Bush Fellowship invests in leaders and their capacity to do more good. Up to 30 leaders receive $150,000 to support their leadership plan. Visit bushfoundation.org.
I'm Giles Snyder with these headlines. Protesters were on the streets of Chicago last night demonstrating against the potential deployment of National Guard troops and immigration agents. Earlier Saturday, President Trump posted a doctored image of himself based on the movie Apocalypse Now. It shows the Chicago skyline with helicopters and flames in the background. Former President Joe Biden's office has announced that his presidential library will be built in his home state of Delaware. Biden represented Delaware in the U.S. Senate for more than 30 years. And in Flushing Meadows, New York, the U.S. Open men's final is today. Yannick Sinner and Carlos Alcaraz will play for the title for the third Grand Slam final in a row. Yesterday, Aryna Sabalenka won the women's championship. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege but a right. Learn more at RWJF.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Democrats hope to take control of the U.S. House in next year's midterm elections, and those hopes might rest on California's governor, Democrat Gavin Newsom. He's asked voters there to pass a redistricting plan that would help Democrats win seats in an attempt to counter Texas, which redrew its maps to favor Republicans. KQED's Marisa Lagos has this report.
Newsom didn't mince words last month as he signed the bill to put his redistricting plan before voters in November. He blamed President Trump's push to change the map in Texas.
We got here because the President of the United States is struggling.
Newsom has never been shy about picking a fight. In 2004, as San Francisco mayor, he threw open the doors of City Hall to same-sex couples and ordered city workers to begin marrying them, despite both state and federal bans on gay marriage. Republican political consultant Mike Madrid traces a straight path from that fight to this battle with Trump.
The culture wars are where the Democrats have gone to run and die. They don't want those fights at all. Gavin's like, give me the sword, I'll go out there. And he wins.
Newsom did try getting along with Trump earlier this year as Los Angeles was consumed by wildfires. But that changed when Trump sent the National Guard into L.A. over Newsom's objections. Since then, Newsom and his staff have taken an increasingly aggressive and cheeky tone. Where Trump has derided Newsom as new scum, the governor is mimicking Trump's social media style with all caps tweets, suggesting Trump has dementia and calling him a loser. More substantively, Newsom is leading the charge to redraw California's congressional districts and, the governor hopes, flip five GOP-held seats into Democratic hands next fall. Newsom's approach is winning praise from many on the left, including 26-year-old Alec Linton, a San Francisco voter who I interviewed after he called into a KQED show.
In general, like, his demeanor and his approach is really what we need. Like, that's honestly, I believe, the only way we're ever going to beat Trump. You got to go to that level.
But the task ahead is tougher than winning on social media. It's convincing voters to support a ballot measure that will sideline the state's popular independent redistricting commission. Still, Linton says the times call for it, even if it means adopting the tactic Trump and Texas are using.
I don't think anybody agrees with gerrymandering. But at the same time, it's kind of necessary. Like, you know, if one side's going to cheat, we have to kind of cheat back. Like, that's life.
Republicans in California see Newsom's move as a blatant power grab. On the assembly floor last month, Assembly Republican leader James Gallagher said Trump was wrong to redistrict and warned that by following the president, Newsom is taking the country down a dangerous path.
Gavin is fighting fire with fire. So now he's pushing this redistricting plan, this Gavinmander. You move forward fighting fire with fire, what happens? You burn it all down. And in this case, it affects our most fundamental American principle, representation.
Even members of his own party have criticized Newsom for his ambitions, possibly including a presidential run. But these days, those voices have quieted down. Here's former California State Senator Mark Leno, who has known Newsom for more than two decades.
Do not think this is all about Gavin and all about Gavin's aspirations. This is about the survival of our nation.
The redistricting campaign is expected to be close and attract money from around the country on both sides. Those close to Newsom say he'll be modeling this fight off his successful 2021 campaign to beat back a recall attempt, which he also focused squarely on Trump and MAGA Republicans. For NPR News, I'm Marisa Lagos in San Francisco.
The Catholic Church canonized the first saint of the millennial generation. Carlo Acutis died of leukemia at 15 years old in 2006. He was nicknamed the saint of the internet and God's influencer for promoting Catholic miracles online. Thousands of people came to the open-air mass to witness the canonization presided over by Pope Leo. NPR's Ruth Sherlock was there and joins us now from the Vatican. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So what did you see there? Like, describe the scene.
Well, look, it's clear that for Catholics, this is an important moment in history. There were these huge crowds, many, many young people. I spoke with one group of teenagers that were wearing these baseball caps with the image of Carlo Acutis' face on them, and they were so excited that they just all talked over each other at once. That's Giulia Logozzo and Laminia Murfone, and they say Acutis is a point of reference for 14-year-olds like them. An inspiration. And, you know, this is exactly the kind of enthusiasm that the church is hoping for. Pope Leo's predecessor, Francis, really pushed forward the case to make Acutis a saint for this reason, because the church wants to attract more young people to the Catholic faith. It can take centuries to become a saint, but for Acutis, it's taken less than 20 years.
You met Acutis's mother recently. What does she tell you?
Well, look, I asked her what she wanted people to remember most about her son, and she told me his kindness.
The love for the others, because Carlo, when he was 9 years old, he started to help the beggar in the street and to take a sleeping bag, blankets, food.
He was born in London and then raised in Milan, and he quickly became a computer whiz. And just as a child, he created this website that documented Catholic miracles. Speaking with his mum, Salzano, I realized how much she's been the driving force in helping her son become canonized today. It's an intense and costly process, and in particular, the saint has to be recognized by the Vatican for bringing about at least two miracles.
So what miracles do the church attribute to the millennial saint?
Well, the Vatican says Acutis healed a 4-year-old Brazilian boy with a serious pancreatic malformation, and he helped a Costa Rican woman make a sudden recovery from this almost fatal biking accident. I went to Assisi, the hilltop town, where you can see his tomb. People look in on the glass side of the tomb and they see this boy. His remains have been reconstructed with silicon, and he's dressed in modern clothes, a tracksuit bottom and Nike sneakers. And there, people are at his tomb praying and crying. There is real passion for this saint. Other parts of his body have been taken as relics. For example, part of his pericardium, the heart sac, is touring the world at the moment. I spoke with a priest who takes this in its glass and gold case around, and they've been to almost 25 countries in less than 2 years. And he says wherever they go, they attract crowds of thousands of people who just want to feel close to Acutis.
That's NPR's Ruth Sherlock in the Vatican. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Open a new picture book and you tumble into a small town at sunset where flowers bloom in the front of a house in the hills up high.
With a rusted old car and the sweet Joe Pie. Where the clothesline sways on a dogwood breeze. Where the road goes to ruts and fades into trees. This is the porch that is crooked and marred. This is the couch that sits in the yard.
The Couch in the Yard is written by Kate Hofler.
It's a story about a family's nighttime ritual of loading up an old car and taking a long drive around the kind of rural areas where they live. These are the gravelly roads that they follow up in the mountains, down through the hollow, past the field with a school bus surrounded by sheep and the storm-down oaks and the old scrap heap, where a night train calls and the hall roads closed and the river's too deep and a tire pop blows. and then eventually flying to the moon. This is the sad to be stuck without light. So their yard car listens and lifts into flight.
For our series, Picture This, author Kate Hoefler and illustrator Dina Seiferling talk about the car rides that inspired their children's book.
The seeds of this story actually came from my own drives with my children in Ohio's Appalachia. It is an area where it has woods, it has farmland. As soon as you take a drive, about a minute out, I begin to feel like I'm almost in my own private world. There are abandoned school buses. There's a yard that I love where there are sheep living in it, but then a bunch of random objects. And I always wonder what the sheep think of the car that they live next to. It is an economically depressed area, and it is also a gorgeous area. I've noticed that a lot of adults will see something in somebody's yard, and it could be a couch, it could be a car, it could be rusted bicycles. And they interpret that as trash, or they interpret it as people who don't care about making a peaceful home. They often use kind of a negative bias towards the people in my area.
Right away when I read the story, I was moved by it. It just really pulled a lot of my own memories and feelings from when I was a kid, driving to visit my grandparents in rural Saskatchewan. There's just all these artifacts of people's lives. And from a passing by standpoint, you might think, oh, it's just garbage. But from a child's perspective, you're looking at something and you're thinking about the possibilities. You're thinking about what things could exist there that are hopeful.
I loved, Dina, that you did have that personal connection. And I loved that someone who lives thousands of miles away also had the same experience of seeing stories in discarded objects. I had seen your work in Night Lunch that you did with Eric Phan. And I think that that's what the story needed. It needed what you did with light.
I'm trying to capture the glow and the light that is, it's not necessarily the moon itself, but it's the light from the moon. It's the light. It's like the universe. And then in terms of color, like it starts out pretty monotone. And I think I wanted to kind of like touch on the stereotype thing. When you first look at it, you may see it as limited or like lacking color or something. And then as you flip through the book, it starts to become more alive and more colorful. And then before they do fly to the moon, they do run into some car trouble and it goes dark. So there is a point in the story where it gets really, really dark. You can just see little glimmers of what's going on. And then as the family gets the engine going again, things brighten up.
I always wonder what artists think about when they have to do a story that takes place at dusk and at night, because I keep thinking that has to be a challenge.
Yeah, it definitely doesn't feel easy. Sometimes I wonder if somebody were to actually follow me through my process, they'd be like, why are you even doing this? But your story was so poetic and there was so much to draw from that way that it did feel effortless. You know how you had like the dogwood trees?
Mm-hmm.
I had included some dogs in the trees at the end.
Those shadowy dogs and trees, that's one of my favorite spreads, where they're both there and not there.
And I think like I was looking at the dogs almost like a quieting of anxieties. They're like going to sleep in the trees and they're not barking anymore. They're kind of like calm.
It's kind of a dreamlike world. And then how you have the things, the real things that the family encounters on the drive clustered in the stars later when they're on the couch and looking up. I would call that visual poem. And I think that's what works so well with your art in this book, is there's so much space to imagine everything because it is in that dusky nighttime atmosphere where you're half awake and half asleep. And there are things that are kind of in shadow and other things illuminated. And it kind of gives readers more space to imagine.
This is me. My brain has been kind of like reshaped a bit from this experience. I just saw a couch for sale down the street. And instead of thinking junk, I thought, oh, I wonder if they loved it. Like, I wonder if they used it well.
I, too, notice it more after writing this book and working on it with you. And I love hearing you say that, because every time now I see something with flowers growing through it, I think about the story behind it. And I have a more tender way of seeing. And I think there's just so much more joy in life if that is the filter that you use when you're looking around you.
That was Kate Hoefler and Dina Seiferling talking about their new children's book, The Couch in the Yard. Our series Picture This is produced by Samantha Balaban. And for more conversations like this one, you can head to npr.org/picturethis. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Goth subculture originated in Britain more than 40 years ago, and it's undergoing something of a resurgence. NPR's Vanessa Romo takes us to Los Angeles, where a regular party blends goth with a much more traditional genre.
The scene outside of the Regent in downtown LA on a recent Saturday night is wild. The venue, which holds 1,000 people, is sold out, and the gaggle of goths waiting to get inside is getting antsy, swaying to the Joy Division bleeding through the doors. Tina Estrella, who's known in these circles as Han Tina, made a 50-mile trek to be here.
I commute an hour over here, but yes.
Where do you live?
So I'm like an hour east, yeah.
It's Gothic Cumbia Night, a mostly monthly dance party combining goth and cumbia music. Cumbia is a genre of Latin American dance music that first became popular in the 60s. It combines guitars, synthesizers, and African-based percussion, and it's most recognizable for its ch-ch-ch-ch-ch kind of rhythm. The night is a chance for LA's Latino goths, or darks, to turn out in their best outfits and sweat the night away. Gothic Cumbia is the witchy brainchild of a Latino American creative collective called Los Goths Company. Its founders keep their identities anonymous. They say they want to maintain a sense of mystery. In a statement, they said their goal is to celebrate their dual identities with, quote, those who find joy in the blend of tradition and darkness. The mashup is clearly resonating with Latino partygoers. Hundreds of first-generation kids who grew up listening to Bauhaus in their bedrooms and Los Angeles Azules at family birthday parties are all flocking to the dance night.
You get that nostalgia of, like, this is the music I grew up on, you know? So it's really fun to have, like, that good balance of, like, the dark wave subculture, but you're also listening to, like, the songs that you would listen to in your dad's car.
It's like the commitment of goth, but with a sense of humor. Goth, pero vaquero, or cowboy. That's Ray Garcia's inspiration. He's become internet famous as Goth Dio. It takes him 3 hours to do his makeup, but his outfits?
I went inside my father's closet, got the leather jacket, got the boots, put the pants and the belts, and try to make it look Western goth. Add my own flavor into the already established vaquero look.
Out on the dance floor, the Los Goths crew have decorated the Stark space with black balloons. The team throws out multicolored light sticks for people to wave around, which they do, gleefully. Up on stage, there are 2 12-foot-tall skeletons, the kind you get at Home Depot around Halloween. There's even a guy on stilts, dressed as a robot, who cumbias his way through the crowds.
I don't know. I've never seen it before. If it has been somewhere, I just haven't been there.
That's Alexia Rodides. They've been trying to make it to Gothic Cumbia for months. As a musician, Rodides loves the collision of their 2 favorite genres. It may seem counterintuitive to others, but if you know, they say. Because in a lot of goth music, and even goth-adjacent stuff, like The Smiths, there's a lot of crossover, according to Rodides.
Because there's a 2-step element to it, and like the 2-step is like a cumbia step, you know what I mean? Because they just, they meld together in like such a beautiful way.
It's definitely a vibe, and one that's gaining momentum. Next month, they'll be in Texas, so get your dark tejanas ready. Vanessa Romo, NPR News.
Oh,
This is NPR News.
You are listening to Weekend Edition this Sunday morning here on member-supported KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Pay nothing to get that old or damaged car towed away, even if it doesn't run. Your donation of a car, boat, or other vehicle is tax deductible. You save time and money while defending the KAXE programs you love. Call 855-277-2346 for details. Find the latest Up North report at KAXE.org. News from our region. Heard on the Morning Show, World Cafe, and All Things Considered, or as a podcast. Is there news in your region we should know about? Email news at KAXE.org. Applications are now open for the University of Minnesota Extension Master Gardener Volunteer Program. Learn how to share science-based horticulture knowledge with people in your area. The course begins in January, and the deadline to apply is October 1st. To learn more, visit z.umn.edu or contact your local extension office.
Kyle Snyder with these headlines. Ukraine is calling the overnight Russian air attack the largest of the war. Ukraine's Air Force says Russia launched more than 800 drones and 13 missiles. Smoke could be seen rising from the main government building in Kyiv. Thousands of Israelis rallied in Tel Aviv last night, appealing to President Trump to force an end to the war in Gaza. This latest weekly demonstration comes as the Israeli military expands an offensive in Gaza City. Two high-rise buildings sheltering Palestinians were destroyed this weekend. And Japanese Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba is stepping down following his party's defeat in July's parliamentary election. And in France, Prime Minister Francois Bayrou faces a no-confidence vote in Parliament tomorrow. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe, and it's time to play the puzzle. Joining us this week is Will Shortz. He's puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition. How's it going, Will?
Excellent. How are you, Aisha?
I am good. Now, before we get into the puzzle challenge, I'd like to talk with you about Susan Stamberg, one of the founding mothers of NPR. She retired last week after more than 50 years with NPR, during which she wore a lot of hats, including being the host of Weekend Edition Sunday.
She was the first host, yeah.
The first host. And during her tenure, she brought you onto the show to baffle us with your brain teasers.
That is fantastic. It's 38 and a half years later, and here we are.
Oh, my goodness. So let's take a little trip down memory lane. Here it is, all the way from the archives, your first ever Sunday puzzle in 1987.
But first, let's see. Oh, here it is. Here's what I was looking for. It's not the comics. It's the games. Will Shortz has promised to puzzle us on Weekend Edition. He is senior editor of Games Magazine. And, Will, you're not exactly going to be doing crossword puzzles, my favorite art form, on the radio for us, but you are going to do logic puzzles, other sorts of things, huh?
I have an original word puzzle for you today.
Uh-huh.
Relating to oxymorons.
Oh, my favorite thing.
Oh, my goodness, Will, you sound so young.
I was so young.
Were you thinking then, oh, I'll be doing this the next 40 years?
Well, you know, at the start, it was just occasional.
Yeah.
You know, there had never been a puzzle feature like this on the radio before, and I believe there still isn't. This is the only one in the world.
Yeah, and it's amazing. And we thank Susan for coming up with this idea. And I am so honored to be, you know, in this position thanks to Susan and the path that she led for us. So we went down memory lane, but now we're just going to go not so far back. We're going to go to last week. So remind us of last week's challenge.
Yes, it came from Mike Reese, who's a showrunner, writer, and producer for The Simpsons. I said, name a famous English author, change the first letter of the last name to an S, then move the first, second, and final letters of that last name to the front of the first name, and the resulting string of letters reading from left to right will name a major American city. What is it? Well, that author is Francis Bacon. Change the B to an S, move the SA into the front, and you get San Francisco.
Oh, okay. There were nearly 500 correct entries, and this week's winner is Cynthia Rose of Littleton, Colorado. Congratulations, Cynthia.
Thank you.
So how did you figure out this week's answer?
Well, I thought the major U.S. city was going to start with an S, so my first thought was San Francisco, and then I thought, well, that includes the name Francis, and the only Francis I could think of was Francis Bacon, and so voila, it just came together.
Well, that's good thinking.
You got it quickly, yeah. Well, how long have you been playing the puzzle?
I've been listening for, 40 years, but just submitting for the last 2 or 3 years.
Oh, okay. What got you to submitting?
Well, one day I was listening and the answer came to me so quickly, I thought, well, maybe I'll just send it in.
And it's paid off.
I guess so. I'm super nervous. I can't believe I'm talking to you two.
No, don't be nervous.
Oh, no, don't be nervous. Don't be nervous.
Okay.
Cynthia, are you ready to play the puzzle?
Well, yes, if I can count on you for backup, I'm
ready. Absolutely. This is going to be great.
Okay. All right.
All right. Take it away, Will.
I'm going to name three things. You tell me something they all have in common. For example, if I said telephone, Saturn, and a tree stump, you would say rings. They all have rings.
Oh, okay.
What do a guitar, a tennis racket, and a marionette all have?
Strings.
Strings is right. A sewing kit, a bowling alley, and an ATM.
Pins.
They all have pins, good. A tennis tournament, an arsonist, and a dating app. Tennis tournament, arsonist, dating app.
What is it, Aisha?
Okay, so the arsonists, what do they use to do those fires?
Match? Oh, match.
They all have matches. Good job. Try this one. A painting, bowling, and glasses.
Frames.
They all have frames. Good one. A canal, a safe, and a head of hair.
Locks.
They all have locks. Good one. Here's your last one. A car trunk, a deck of cards, and the film Titanic. What's something that basically every car trunk has? In case you have a flat tire, what do you need?
Spare.
You have a spare, and what do you use to put that spare tire on your car?
Well, I don't know. I've never done it.
So it's a car deck. What do you put it in the car? Oh, a jack!
Oh, yes.
I have jacks.
Obviously, I've never done it. I couldn't even think of Jack.
This was a fun one.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Because I was getting stuck on that one too, Cynthia. I was like, what do you put the tire in the butt?
And it's Jack and Rose on the Titanic.
Yeah, that was good.
But Cynthia, you did an amazing job. How do you feel?
I feel like eating a big bowl of ice cream right now.
Well, you deserve it.
Yes, I think I do.
You definitely deserve it for playing our puzzle today. Today, you'll get a weekend edition lapel pin as well as puzzle books and games. You can read all about it at npr.org/puzzle. And Cynthia, what member station do you listen to?
We're members of Colorado Public Radio, CPR.
That's Cynthia Rose of Littleton, Colorado. Thanks for playing the puzzle.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Will, what's next week's challenge?
Yes, it comes from Joseph Young of St. Cloud, Minnesota. Think of a popular commercial name that ends with the names of two male animals, one after the other. And if you have the right commercial name, its first six letters can be rearranged to spell the name of an NFL team. What is it? So again, a popular commercial name, it ends with the names of two male animals, one after the other. And if you have the right commercial name, the first six letters can be rearranged to spell the name of an NFL team. What team is it?
You have your assignment, puzzlers? When you have the answer, go to our website, npr.org/puzzle, to submit your response. Just fill out the form on the puzzle page. Remember, just one entry, please. Our deadline for entries this week is Thursday, September 11th at 3 p.m. Eastern. Don't forget to include a phone number where we can reach you. If you're the winner, we'll give you a call. And if you pick up the phone, you'll get to play on the air with the puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition, Will Shortz. Thank you, Will.
Thank you, Aisha.
From trendy restaurants in Washington, D.C. to buzzy pop-up dinners in Brooklyn, West African food is having a moment. Justin Cremon, it reports on one chef who's using an unexpected sense to recreate the Nigerian flavors of his youth.
It's hard to explain Shola Olunloyo's job. Raised in Nigeria and now based in Philadelphia, he's a technical consultant in the food industry, which means he's the guy you call when you have a cooking problem.
Similar to just calling in the Navy SEALs and doing like a quick extraction and nobody knows you were there.
Many major restaurants in Philly and beyond have relied on him to design menus or choose an oven. Like a true fixer, Olunloyo takes a meticulous, unsentimental approach to his work. But he holds a special place in his heart for one dish.
Nigerian jollof rice. From the time I was like, I have any memory of like being a human being, I remember jollof rice.
He's cooked the dish since he was 10 years old. And because of those memories, he knows when it's done simply by the sound of the rice in the pot. How confident do you feel that you could nail the doneness completely by sound?
Pretty confident.
I decided to put that to the test to see if Olunloyo could cook a jollof rice by sound. The culinary fixer accepted my challenge, and I brought two exacting tasters to his home in South Philadelphia to judge the results.
My name is Craig LeBan. I'm the restaurant critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
My name is Dara Andiazuma. I am the owner and founder of CSU West African Grill.
We head outside to the coal-powered burner in Olunloyo's backyard to watch him cook. Nigerian jollof starts with some aromatics sautéed in a heavy pot.
This is just red onions, yeah. A hint of thyme. And some curry powder.
You add a spiced tomato sauce, which holds a lot of the flavors, and some broth.
Then you add your rice, cover it pretty tight, and let it cook till it's essentially done. So now is where sound becomes important.
Like, literally, we can't see what's going on.
Yeah, we can't see.
Listen to this.
There's a wet bubble, which is different from a dry sizzle. You see what I mean?
Restaurant owner Endi Azuma, who grew up in Nigeria, says he's seen his mom cook this way. She'll be sitting in the living room and call out to his sister in the kitchen.
Telling her, reduce the heat. I can hear this making the sound.
As the critic LeBan puts it,
great chefs have all their senses awake when they're cooking.
Olunloyo updates us on the rice.
The sound is more higher pitch now, less wet.
He says there's one final step to a Nigerian party jollof.
Let it burn just a tin of it on the bottom. Yay.
Hearing the sizzle of the rice, he knows it's done.
What level of confidence do you feel right now?
I feel 100% confident.
We go inside to taste. Endi Azuma first.
It's just even, you know, nothing is overpowering the other. So the tomato, the chicken stock, the smokiness, it just hits you.
LeBan next.
It's like a warm, sunny, beautiful flavor. I just love crunching on that rice. I'll give him two thumbs up, which is pretty rare for me.
LeBan points out that Olunloyo made his name cooking French sauces and technically innovative food, but
when Shola cooks something like jollof rice, he starts with a memory of home.
Or as Olunloyo says,
fundamentally, it's the same thing that I used to eat growing up. I think I'm just as excited or surprised as you guys.
That all those years of detailed technical work have led him right back to his childhood. For NPR News, I'm Justin Cremon in Philadelphia.
As the summer vacation was wrapping up, a Scottish teacher posted this video on TikTok.
Explain to me why Scottish school holidays are a bit of a washout. Right. It's been all right this year, but it's been a bit of a washout.
Torgy Squire was having a mild rant about the state of the weather and signed off by saying,
anyway, hope you're all having a belter of a day. Catches.
A few days later, the video had millions of views, hundreds of thousands of likes, and tens of thousands of comments. The reason, apart from the cute accent, is that Squire is black. It seems many Americans were surprised to hear a black man speak with a Scottish accent. Torgy Squire joins us now from the city of Glasgow. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Aisha. What a welcome. It's so funny hearing my video played back again.
Yeah, well, I mean, because, like, how shocked were you by the reaction? Like, when did you realize, like, oh, this is really taking off?
You know, it got to maybe 24 or 48 hours after I posted the video, and I actually had to turn my notifications off because my phone was just blowing up crazy.
Well, have you ever experienced this kind of reaction from people before who are not from Scotland? Like, they see you, a tourist or something see you, and they kind of react?
Well, do you know, it's funny, no matter where I go, some people will react and it's quite calm. They'll say, oh, what is that accent? Is that Irish? Is it Welsh? But mm-hmm. I was in Barbados, where my mum is from, last summer, and a woman called me a unicorn. That was the first time I'd ever been called that. She said, you are a unicorn, black and Scottish. I've never seen this.
So you have gotten a reaction before, but just not on this level.
Not to this scale that Black America came through in the comments, and it's been crazy ever since.
What are you thinking of us?
I love it. I mean, we consume a lot of American culture here, mm-hmm. whether you're black or white and Scottish, but I certainly immerse myself in black comedy. It was always growing up, it was The Fresh Prince, and then after that it was My Wife and Kids. I'm really showing my age here. But it's been amazing. So see, to be embraced like that from the other side of the world with people calling you, you're our cousin now, your cousin, and supporting the things that I've done and going back into old posts. I've done cultural videos about the differences about being black and Scottish and the similarities. So it's amazing to see the Americans take on things, and I love that. I love it.
Well, what's the difference? What's one difference that you pointed out in some old videos about being black in Scotland versus being black in America?
I could go days, weeks, and months without seeing another black person if I don't visit my immediate family. If I'm in the city, it's different. There is a growing black population. Mm-hmm. But if I went outside of the city, somewhere quite remote, I could not see another black face.
Mm, yeah. Well, I mean, ultimately, I guess from this experience, like, what's one thing that you want people to know, I guess, about black people in Scotland, but also to know about you?
I want people to know that black people in Scotland probably aren't dissimilar to black people in America. Mm-hmm. I mean, our experiences of growing up and racism are probably very alike, but on a much smaller scale. On a much smaller scale. I could probably count on both hands in 44 years of life on this earth the number of times I've been openly involved in a racist incident directed towards me. And that's, I don't know, could a lot of Americans say the same thing? Mm-hmm. And you know, so that the similarities and their differences, whilst I still live in a very small black population, for the most part is very, very welcoming. And I can only speak from my experience, but it's certainly been more positive than negative. But I also want Americans to know that they're so welcome here. I mean, Scotland is throwing its arms open to black America. we would love, we get the big cousins reunion planned for August next year. I have never been to a cookout.
You never
so
been
we
to
call
a
them barbecues here.
Oh, yeah.
But I've never been to a cookout, and I need to experience that.
You got to get to the cookout. Well, that is wonderful. That social media sensation, Torgy Squire. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Luminescence Foundation. Luminescence Foundation is dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from the Bonner Eye Clinic, with locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, offering cataract surgery, LASIK, and general eye exams. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly. The Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources offers the Lawns to Legumes program to increase habitat for at-risk pollinators in residential settings. The deadline for the 2026 season is November 30th. Find more info and apply at bluethumb.org. The Tally Gallery at Bemidji State University hosts a new retrospective exhibit of work by Marley Call, looking back at Call's 60-year artistic journey with some never-before-seen works, on display through October 30th. Greater Lakes Area Performing Arts and Pequot Lakes Community Theater present Annie, September 18th through the 28th, at Pequot Lakes High